The All Terrain Podcast is self-funded and self-supported through sales of merch on our website, allterrainpodcast.com. If you're tired of hearing about audiobooks, subscription socks, mail order food, or, and I'm not kidding about this, toilet bowl perfume, please check out our website and buy a sticker, hat, or morale patch.
Come all the way off the ground.
Falling short of Susavle, we stopped in Nodnub for the night. Much of the current popular overlanding trend can be traced its roots back to South Africa, and after staying in Nodnub and similar lodges, it's easy to see why. These ranches provide a place to park and camp for a small sum of money, and doing so entitles you to all of their facilities, which include, amongst other things, flush toilets and hot showers at each of our stops. We don't have a similar framework of businesses in the United States, which is a shame because I could camp in a rooftop tent and eat ramen every night as long as I got a decent shower and a flush toilet.
Howdy friends, welcome to the All Terrain Podcast, the show about going places where I, Mike Henderson, talk to adventure travelers of all kinds and ask them how they poop in the backcountry. This is episode one, and the voice you just heard is our guest today. He's a writer and photographer who our 4x4 loving listeners have surely read over the past 15 or so years. Harry Wagner writes about four-wheeling, hardcore rock crawling, and the associated vehicles for magazines like Four Wheeler, Peterson's Four Wheel and Off-Road, JP Magazine, ORA, Diesel Power, and more. He funds his adventures with a geophysics day job, which takes him to remote areas for field work like Adak, Alaska, in the Aleutian Islands, and the Colorado High Country, where he worked at Camp Hale outside Leadville, and cleaning up unexploded ordnance at old military bases. Harry's an Eagle Scout who grew up camping and has lived in Venezuela and visited South Africa. Today you can find him on Instagram at @HarrySituations. Harry Wagner, thanks so much for coming.
Thanks for having me, Mike. I'm flattered.
So the quote we began the show with today is from one of your articles in, I think, Four Wheeler magazine about overlanding in South Africa. You mentioned that in a conversation that overlanding is very different there. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think there's just a lot more remote places in South Africa. And on that trip, we actually went into Namibia, north of South Africa, and just a lot of dirt roads. And we're lucky enough to live in Nevada, where we do have wide open spaces. But even here, if you travel very far in one direction, you're going to hit pavement, which didn't seem to be the case there.
Yeah, I remember when I moved to Nevada almost 20 years ago, I was pleasantly surprised at how easy it is to get to the middle of nowhere here. You know, it's we're a lot closer here than other places. But, you know, like I look at videos and articles from Australia, you know, and that's, you know, there's a lot of stuff around the perimeter. Well, there's a little bit of stuff around the perimeter.
Right, relatively speaking.
And then a whole lot of nothing in the middle. And it really captures my imagination for sure. Africa too.
Yeah, I have never been to Australia. That's on the bucket list still. But Africa is a very captivating place.
Yeah, for sure. So you do geophysics. What is that work like?
It's interesting. I enjoy it. That's what I went to school for. And my description of geophysics to people is, if you think of biophysics in terms of CAT scans and MRIs, we essentially do the same thing in the ground. And that can be used to look for oil or minerals often. And in my case, we're looking for unexploded ordnance at old military bases.
That sounds kind of exciting.
Yeah, I've never had any issues. I just have to find it. Someone else has to dig it up. So my part of that is fairly safe, but it's presented the opportunities to go to some amazing places where there's also overland travel or off-roading or rock climbing and camping. So that's a nice perk of the job.
And the downside is there's not a whole lot of unexploded ordinances in Reno, Nevada, hopefully.
Not in Reno per se, but north of here in Honey Lake and certainly in Hawthorne, Nevada has its share of unexploded ordnance and military bases.
You know what? In Nevada, we did a trip. We drove basically overland back from near Lovelock, a Seven Troughs mine area.
Yeah.
And we found some really untraveled roads and drove up over this pass to a mine, you know, with like an open mine shaft with collapsing things coming down from the top and just random holes in the ground. So you can, I don't know if there's not a lot of like bombs out there, hopefully, but there are a lot of really dangerous things in Nevada for sure.
Absolutely, yeah.
All right, so let's get right into the interesting part. Are you ready?
Yeah.
All right.
Let's go.
So first of all, I know you do a lot of four-wheeling, like rock crawling and that sort of thing, and that's, you know, the difference between that and overlanding is just, I think, one of degrees. You know, certainly if you do the Rubicon Trail, you're camping out in the middle of it, that's kind of overlanding, I would think. You know, the difference between the two is sort of academic in certain cases. So don't feel like you have to limit yourself to just times when you're going down dirt roads. Let's talk about everything.
That sounds great. Yeah, and I enjoy all of it. I agree with you. When people think of rock crawling on the competition end of things, it might be you go a matter of 100 yards. I grew up four-wheeling with my family. My dad had an off-road shop in Northern California, and we spent a lot of time on trails like Fordyce for Sierra Trek and the Rubicon. And I don't know if I thought of those in terms of overlanding at the time, but we were certainly self-sufficient. You brought all of your food for the whole trip. You brought your camping gear, and mm-hmm. it was a multi-day trip. It wasn't just let's find the most extreme obstacle. We also didn't trailer back then.
Right.
I mean, you drove everywhere, so your best interest to keep your vehicle running. And
right,
that.
And they didn't have 42-inch tires on everything back then either.
Exactly.
So these days, who's in your crew? Who do you go out with these days, family or friends?
Still my folks to some extent. They enjoy it. They live here in Reno as well, and we like to explore places like Berlin Ichthyosaur or go up to High Rock Canyon in the Black Rock Desert. I have friends too that probably I go more often with friends than with family and just about anywhere. So the trip to South Africa, what prompted that was a friend from college actually was working in Cape Town. And so I made a couple trips to visit him, and he and I then from there jumped off and went and explored into Namibia or into some great national parks that South Africa has. So friends oftentimes, and they're some of my greatest memories are going on these trips with friends.
Yeah.
You get away from cell service and all the normal parts of life that distract you and eat up your time and just get the chance to relax and have some great conversations and really bond.
Yeah, disconnecting is one of the things that I think a lot of people really love about any of these sports, honestly. You know, it's what frustrates me when people want to try and figure out ways to connect your phone back to civilization, you know, somehow when you're out there. It's like, well, man, it's nice just being gone for a while.
Absolutely, yeah. That's one of my favorite parts of leaving the country is I don't have an international plan and
right.
don't plan to change that anytime soon.
Yeah.
If I'm out of the country, then I don't necessarily want to be reached.
Yep. So I know you've got a number of vehicles that you don't actually post about your overlanding vehicle much. I see your tracker, but what's your overlanding vehicle?
Yes. So I have 8 vehicles in my fleet
at
the moment. Yeah. We won't go through all of them because it would take up the whole show. Half of them are Toyotas. I'm definitely Toyota biased. And I currently have a 96 Tacoma, so an early Tacoma. Kurt Williams from Cruiser Outfitters in Utah affectionately calls it the poverty package because it's 4-cylinder, manual transmission, crank windows, manual door locks, manual hubs.
Right.
It's about as simple as it gets, which I find is a benefit when you're in the backcountry. There's just a lot less to go wrong. And it's
Absolutely.
Sort of a really simple truck. One of the upgrades I made, I'm kind of jumping ahead here, but it has big shocks on it, which mm-hmm. I think is great, not just for racing, but backcountry travel. It has 2.5-inch King shocks on it, and then Cooper ST Max tires. And other than that, it's fairly close to stock.
So tell what's the deal with big shocks, King shocks? What's like I see those a lot. I have Bill Stein, you know, the silver ones.
Sure.
Everybody
yeah,
has.
Probably 5100s. They're normal monotube shock. That's a good shock too. I find as you mentioned, my background is in rock crawling. So early on for me, it was you just took a tape measure, you try and find the longest shock you can fit, you put it on, and that was about it. And I had a third gen 4Runner like the one you have now.
Right.
And it had Old Man Umu suspension on it, which is a very good suspension, certainly a step up from a lot of, you know, just having a, a spacer or some of the other things on the market. And then I got Icon 2.5-inch rebuildable shocks on it front and rear, and it blew my mind because that just the control, the rebound, if you go over bumps, it just settles the vehicle immediately. And, you know, the 4Runner had ARB locking differentials and a winch, and I didn't use those things very often, but the shocks I felt every day, you notice, whether you're on the road or off-road, you just notice the value of having high-quality shocks and the way they soak up bumps and irregularities. So that's kind of my first upgrade now for any vehicle I get is big shocks.
So the shocks will, I mean, you'll notice the improvement in the ride. I always assumed that it was, you know, for going fast.
I think it allows you to go faster by having a larger diameter shock. You have more fluid volume, so they don't fade as they heat up over washboard roads. And then also the piston itself is physically larger, so it allows for more precise tuning, and it's more, the larger piston can more easily control the motion of the vehicle.
Interesting. So when you say, I don't want to get too bogged down into details, but the shocks thing I think is one thing that's important to a lot of overlanders. Like a lot of people are like, to convince me, why should I buy the fancy shocks? So in my 4Runner on the 5100s, and I'm going down, you know, a bumpy dirt road, say it's washboard, say it's there's ruts here and there and rocks. What's the difference in feel? What am I going to feel, say, you know, like right away or maybe even after an hour of driving like that, that's going to change when you get the bigger shocks?
Certainly the longer you're on those sort of roads, the more you're going to notice the difference because the shocks won't fade. There's more oil, so they don't heat up as much. But even I think for short distances, you're going to be able to go faster if you want, potentially, or you're just going to have more control because the shock can control the movement of the vehicle and the tire and wheel better.
Right.
So it is a big investment for sure. There's no doubt about that. And it's something you can't necessarily see. Like you can see a rooftop tent or a roof rack or something like that. The shocks are under the vehicle, so they don't have the same visual impact. But for me, that's the first place I spend my money these days.
Interesting. That's good to know. So tell us a little bit about the Tracker before we move on.
Sure. Yeah. So my latest vehicle, of the 8 vehicles I own, 0 are Jeeps, which a lot of people find surprising. My first vehicle was a CJ7, so I'm not anti-Jeep.
Yeah, mine too.
Awesome. And we both had manual transmission 3rd-gen 4Runners.
Right.
The Tracker was built by Jesse Haynes here in Reno, and I approached him about wanting a lightweight, nimble rock crawler. By starting with a Tracker, it was a vehicle that's relatively inexpensive, and the proportions are good for off-roading. And then he built a custom suspension, and we added a Samurai transfer case and Toyota axles, and it's really capable and different than what you see out there, which I like. I like to build things that are a little different than
everything else
that's out there.
It looks, at the same time, it looks understated and kind of monstery to it
all at the same time. Well, and I have one of my vehicles is a Ford F-150, a 77 F-150.
Oh, cool.
And my friend Vern Simons and I drove that truck from Ensenada to Cabo San Lucas and back, and it's on 42-inch tires. And so that was sort of an overland. I guess any vehicle can be an overlanding vehicle depending on where you take it.
For sure. Depending. Although it'd probably be a lot more difficult to turn the to go overlanding in the Tracker.
Storage space is the biggest limiting factor.
You could either have a cooler full of beer or a clothes bag or something.
Right.
But you only
get to pick one,
So let's talk about the Toyota. That's your overlanding vehicle. How do you carry your gear in that vehicle primarily?
It's a regular cab truck, which is a limiting factor, I find. I really liked the platform of the 4Runner like you have more than this truck. Part of the reason I bought this Tacoma was because I regretted selling my 4Runner and had an opportunity to buy this. But in the bed, I have a cap on it. I carry stuff in the bed that is lockable storage, but it's without the second set of doors, it's difficult to reach stuff at the front of the bed. Typically, it's me and one other person, so everything we have fits in the bed of the truck.
Right.
I did a trip to Mexico in that truck earlier this year also, and with a friend, and we found you basically can't put any gear in the front because it's a regular cab truck.
Right,
so
yeah.
Everything had to go in the bed. But we used Action Packers. I'm a big fan of case, like I'm a case nerd. So
right,
I have
me too.
Hardig cases. I have some hard aluminum cases. Now the name is escaping me off the top of my head. But,
oh, I know the ones, the Alubox or something. Is it the really fancy ones?
These are really fancy. It's Zargus. That's
Zargus,
what they are.
Okay.
Zargus cases, Hardig cases, Action Packers as well, Pelican cases. So I like to keep camera gear in one, food prep in another,
right,
food in another, camera gear. I guess I already said, but.
Yeah. And those are probably like waterproof, shockproof. Can use it to serve as a flotation device.
Yeah, the Hardig cases in particular are my current favorite. They have handles on the outside, so they're easy to strap down. They're waterproof and dustproof, which is nice if you're traveling in distant locations or even across Nevada. Again, the 4Runner is all sealed inside,
yeah,
where the pickup truck, even with the camper shell, is not exactly sealed.
No.
So I don't want to leave my camera gear and
right,
out
yeah,
into the elements.
Yeah, not on. I use a Pelican case a lot of times for camera gear.
Yeah, they're great.
Yeah, it's super bomber. But you don't bolt stuff to the top?
It has a roof rack on it, and I put my bike up there when I'm going mountain biking. Otherwise, because it's a regular cab, I think the limitation is just you can only take two people anyway.
Right.
If it was a quad cab truck, then maybe the situation would be different, and I would put stuff on the roof. I typically like to keep stuff inside just so it's I don't have any kids, so I kind of have that luxury
yeah,
of having the space, and then it doesn't get caught up on trees or you don't have to worry about it walking off and disappearing and things
right,
like that.
Yeah. Some vehicles you see have quite a big investment bolted to the outside
yeah,
of the vehicle, and I'm sure people lock it up, but it still seems sketchy at sometimes. So pretty minimalist then, for the most
I
part.
I would say, yeah, I would describe myself as a minimalist. One of the trips that Peterson's Four Wheel and Off-Road does every year is the Ultimate Adventure, which is a rock crawling trip. But this year, for instance, we covered over 900 miles and 700 of those were off-road. So
wow,
in essence, I mean, that wasn't all rock crawling by any means. We explored the north rim of the Grand Canyon
oh,
and the Arizona
cool,
Strip. And last year on that trip, we went through Death Valley and Yosemite.
I saw
and
then that
up
one. That
to the
was,
Rubicon.
That was cool.
Yeah, it was great. And the reason I bring it up is, as a minimalist, I actually flew into San Luis Obispo and rode with Fred Williams on that trip.
Oh, okay.
And I brought one North Face duffel bag, and it had, I didn't even bring a tent. I had a bivy, I had a sleeping bag, all my clothes for the week, a sleeping pad, and that was about it. So I do try and stay relatively minimalist, even on multi-week trips.
Right. For the viewer or listeners, a bivy, you say bivy, you mean a bivy sack, like a, would be like a sleeping bag, just, but like a Gore-Tex shell of a sleeping bag that you zip up and sleep in that, right?
Exactly, yeah. So I had a sleeping bag, and then I had a liner to go on the inside if we got too cold, and then I had this bivy, which, as you're saying, is just a Gore-Tex shell you put
right,
over the sleeping bag to keep it dry.
Yeah, I've used those. I used one of those on bike packing trips. It's less than comfortable. Mine is, because you have to slide in from the top, but it's light.
Fortunately,
you know?
I never needed to use it. We
oh,
had
good
weather, and so I was able to just sleep on the sleeping bag. But because it's a down bag, I didn't want to risk
right.
having it get wet.
And on those, on these Ultimate Adventure trips, you're working on those. You're taking pictures, right?
Correct. So that's typically why I ride along with someone
right,
else. As much as I like overlanding and off-roading, if I'm working, it's much easier for me to, even if I bring my own vehicle, have someone else drive
right,
and allow me to focus on my work rather than trying to deal with, oh, my vehicle broke or it's in the
yeah,
way or some amazing shot I miss because I'm driving.
Right.
So that is a work trip, but it's not a bad job.
No, I believe it. So, all right, that's the gear. What do you eat on these trips? What's
very poorly.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Yeah,
it was
cookies, right? Or biscuits.
I eat a lot of cookies.
Chocolate cookies.
Yeah, I definitely have a sweet tooth. I think part of it for me is the food prep. If I do it ahead of time, I eat pretty good, but I don't like to spend a lot of time on these trips with the cleanup or with food prep. To me, when we get to our destination, I want to relax. And so if that means I bring a pizza and that's what I eat as I sit around and the campfire and talk to friends, or yeah, cookies, instant meals, backpacking meals, things like that are typically what I do. I have some friends that get real elaborate and I like to go with them and
reap the benefits.
Food. Yeah, exactly. But it, for me, I mean, a jet boil and heating something up is about as fancy as I get.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I definitely see the benefit of going that way. Backpacker food. Have you ever tried to eat like a Mountain House dinner for lunch at work? Just like you eat it for lunch at home or something. And you're like, wait a minute, this isn't just like when you're backpacking, it's amazing. It's
right,
great. It's
yeah.
delicious. When you're home, you're like, oh, that's not.
Yeah. The bar is in a little different place.
Yeah. So where do you sleep?
I like to sleep on the ground. I bring a tent. I have a pretty small Sierra Designs tent that has a vestibule. You can leave your shoes or your backpack outside. And then I have an Expedition Down Exped Sin mat. That is probably my favorite piece of kit.
Exped is awesome.
Yeah.
We have Expeds.
Yeah. For years, I used sort of thin backpacking pads and...
Right.
They're tolerable, but this, I sleep all night. I don't,
right.
One hip gets sore and you roll over and the other hip gets sore. And so that is the most important piece. If it's nice, I'll sleep in my bag outside on the pad.
Yep.
And if it's not, then I'll sleep in the tent. I actually, this isn't a paid endorsement or anything, but the way I became a fan of their product, I went to the Dakar Rally in South America. And for 2 weeks straight, I slept on the roof of a truck on this pad. And it got filthy dirty in the process. And when I got back, I approached them and said, what's the best way to clean this? And they said, oh, you have the old model. We'll just send you a new one.
Nice.
Free of charge. That made me a lifelong customer right there.
Yeah. We got their mega mats 2 or 3 years ago. And they loop together.
Oh,
to
nice.
Be a, the mega mats are huge. It's like 30 inches wide or something. So it makes a big bed. And they're so comfortable. They're like 4 inches thick, but then they still compress down as small as like your, you know, our old
The Thermarest stuff, yeah. Or other things for backpacking.
But so comfortable and durable. And you know, I've had enough shoulder injuries that I can't sleep on the GuideLite 3/4 mattress anymore.
Right.
Those days are behind me. Where do you poop?
I am not necessarily a big fan of pooping outdoors, but when I do, it's typically just a cat hole.
Yep.
Like you, I have a little kit that has a little shovel in it, and it's got a roll of toilet paper and a Ziploc bag that I carry with me in the vehicle. I also, all of my vehicles, I have wet wipes and just the little individual Kleenex packs in the door in case you need them. But... yeah, I don't carry anything more sophisticated than that. I guess being a minimalist or the concerns about packing it out, it seems easier just to dig a hole.
Yeah, I don't know of too many places in the United States where you can drive to that require that you pack your waste out.
Right.
That don't also have a facility of some kind.
The Rubicon would be one. They have Port-a-Johns. Well, not Port-a-Johns. They have... outhouses on the trail now that get pumped, so you can use those, but they also don't recommend digging a cat hole because the soil there is so shallow, it's just granite. And they've had some issues in the past with human waste and contaminating some of the lakes.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's good to know. So what recovery gear do you carry or do you recommend that people carry? I guess we'll talk about... overlanding and rock crawling separately for this.
Sure. Yeah, in rock crawling, I typically, most of my vehicles have winches.
Right.
And the winch, I feel, is really controlled recovery or getting over an obstacle. Overlanding, it seems like you're stuck in sand or silt beds, situations where a kinetic recovery rope, like a Bubba rope or a Master Pull rope, I have those in my vehicles, and they really come in handy. And then all the associated shackles, D-rings, soft shackles, things like that, I carry too. I have got some Max Tracks. I haven't used them yet. I haven't had to, but I do carry those, and I do carry a shovel. Recovery gear is something I'm heavy on.
Right. Tell us a little bit about soft shackles. I know what it is. I've never touched one before.
Sure. Yeah, so the first company I was familiar with making these was Bubba Rope. Theirs is called the Gator Jaw, and it basically is a piece of synthetic winch line that has a big knot on one end and a loop, and instead of having to use a metal D-ring, you can use this to attach a recovery point to a winch line or a strap.
Right.
And they're very lightweight. Same benefits as a synthetic winch line. They're
right.
Light. You can handle them without gloves.
They store energy.
Exactly.
And they're, as I understand, they're far stronger than an iron shackle. Is that right?
Yeah, they are.
Like, and working load limit is higher.
Correct. It is. The other issue with a traditional shackle is the direction of the load, right? You're a rock climber, so
right.
You understand, like with carabiners too, as far
right.
as cross-loading them, or it's the same thing with a D-ring shackle. If you pull on both sides, you're not going to be able to get the pin out anymore. You're
right.
going to deform that.
Hacksaw that thing off.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you don't have to worry about that with the soft shackles either.
Now, other soft shackles, it seems like they are, they're constructed in a way that aren't the ends just kind of braided together, like looped together? It's not like, the construction seems pretty simple. Like, do people hand make those?
I have seen some that were made by hand from pieces of synthetic winch line.
Mm.
The one, I'll have to bring in one for you. The Bubba Rope one, the way this knot that's on the end of it is super tight, super
uh-huh.
dense, and they use a machine. I don't recall the specs off the top of my head, but it is pretty impressive. The knot is not going to come out. There's no concern about that. And there's no loose ends or fraying or anything
right.
like that. They have little details also, like there's a, it looks like heat shrink, but there's in essence a part of it that's abrasion resistant.
Oh,
so
see,
if you're putting
yeah.
it through a recovery point on your vehicle, you don't have to worry about abrading it.
Right. Yeah, I need to get some of those soft shackles. They look light, honestly.
Yeah, which is, even if you're carrying them and not using them, right? If you
right.
roll over or have some sort of incident,
that's true.
Then just having something that isn't going to become a projectile is a nice benefit as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, that's true. When you're traveling, when you get to camp, do you have like an onboard shower or shower kit, or you just hop in the nearest lake or stream?
We don't have that luxury always in Nevada,
no.
certainly. I have one of those solar showers. It works okay.
Like the bag that you hang
exactly,
out.
Exactly, yeah, and you heat up. I've used that. I don't have an onboard shower. It would come in handy. You need to be near a water source for those to work. And
that's true.
If I'm near a water source, I usually just go swimming.
Right.
Going back to Dakar, where we were in the desert, I found my morning routine became just a half-liter bottle of water over the head and soap, washing the face, kind of washing my head. And that sufficed as a shower. And you feel pretty clean afterwards, enough
right.
to get you through another day.
I find that when it comes to getting clean, if you can just like get your face clean, get your neck clean, maybe your forearms or something, and then it's like, all right, everything I can see is clean. The rest is just going to have to suffer until I get home.
Right. Or maybe baby wipes to
baby
make
wipes,
up the
yeah.
difference.
Yeah. Those are nice too. Can you think of a time where you got somewhere and you were really thankful to find a lake or a stream that was particularly refreshing?
Yeah, I guess Fordyce Creek Trail is the one that comes to mind for me. Or the Rubicon. Buck Island Lake is the middle of the trail. And those trails are in the High Sierras are incredibly dusty. And typically I'm walking, I'm taking pictures, filthy dirty. And those high alpine lakes are refreshing and definitely clean you up and wake you up at the same time.
Yeah, for sure. All right, let's talk about communication. What do you use on your trips to communicate either between vehicles or longer distances?
I am bad about this. I really need to get my ham license. It has
yeah.
been on my to-do list for probably 4 years now.
Yeah.
And there's classes around here. There's
yep.
ham crams. I always seem to be out of town when they're happening, so I haven't done that. I have used race radios, which are in essence the same
mm-hmm.
thing, in Mexico to transmit from vehicle to vehicle. I've also used just the little handheld radios, like you mentioned. I have a CB. I don't remember the last time I used it.
Yeah.
So I need to take that ham class because a lot of the guys I travel with, that's how they communicate.
Yeah, I know. I noticed on the local 4x4 forum, they talk about doing the trail runs, and they list the 2 meter frequency first,
right.
and then have a lot of derision for CB and other communication after that. So I can tell you that that ham is very nice. The ham radios are super nice, and like you, CB is, if you can find somebody that's got it, it's still almost useless, you know.
Right. Yeah. If you have line of sight, and at that point you can just honk at him.
Right. Yeah.
Well, maybe that'll motivate me to finally get that ham license.
Yeah. It's not as hard as you might be fearing. I mean, there's the book. There's a good book. Gordon something wrote this book. He's like the guru of that. In fact, the book comes with a CD, you know, compact disc, like the music things that was from back in the day. And I have it. It's the CD in my Forerunner. So if I'm punching through my radio thing and I hit stop on CD, it's my ham radio class starts playing over the radio. So
I'm sure the family finds that entertaining.
Yeah, they think it's funny. What do you use for navigation? How do you find where you're going?
It depends on the circumstances.
For
I
places
guess.
That you don't already know.
Sure. Yeah. Exactly. A lot of times I'm going to a place with someone who knows their way around. I love atlases and paper maps, and I carry those in my vehicles because you always have them. They're pretty reliable. I do use GPS as well, like a Lowrance for racing.
Mm-hmm.
And those are kind of clunky to use in a vehicle, but they seem to be the standard in racing. LeadNav is an app that I have on my phone. I don't have a tablet, so I haven't committed to getting a tablet, but I probably would just for this LeadNav application. It's become really popular in the racing community and also for overlanding. It seems to be the app of choice as far as route finding, so I would like to use that a little more. And then I recently got a Magellan TRX Explorer 7. They sponsored Ultimate Adventure, so we had some of those on the trip this year, and that was pretty useful too. It's on a tablet and touchscreen, so that was a useful tool too that I hadn't previously used.
Cool. Why do you think I like paper maps too? Why do you think? What's the attraction, do you think, to paper maps?
I use technology in my job every day, and most of the time it's great, but it does have its limitations, and a lot of the trips I take are spontaneous, and as a result, I haven't necessarily downloaded that area or have the maps. The paper maps are always there, and there's just some sense of beauty. There's something romantic about looking at a map. You see things maybe you weren't looking for, where with a GPS, I feel like it just tells you where you want to go, but maybe there's something wonderful that you wouldn't have otherwise found. And on a paper map, you see this little dotted line and you think, oh, where did that go?
Exactly.
That's part of the appeal.
Exactly. What non-driving activities do you like to do when you're out overlanding or rock crawling?
Nature photography, nature photography, obviously. I also enjoy mountain biking, rock climbing. I haven't done in a while. I lived in Albuquerque and I had a circle of friends there that I climbed with. I don't have the same circle in Reno, but that's something that really interests me. Hiking. I haven't done a lot of fishing, but I'm headed to the Doozy Ersham Trail at the end of the month, and which is dotted with lakes all along the trail, and I definitely plan on doing some fishing on that trip, getting my California out-of-state license, and hopefully that, as you mentioned, the tracker doesn't have a lot of storage space, so I'm hoping to catch my dinner each night.
Yeah, that's going to conflict with your minimalist cooking approach, too.
It will.
You're just going to wrap it on a stick and roast it over a fire, maybe.
Yep. If I bring some tinfoil and some salt and pepper, I should be good.
Right. So tell us about the Doozy Ersham Trail real quick. That's one that's an amazing, inspiring trail.
Yeah. Absolutely. My birthday is at the end of August, and I mentioned I lived in Albuquerque. One of my good friends comes to Reno every year. It's become this tradition, and he and I have run the Rubicon. We've gone through Fordyce Creek Trail. We've done Barrett Lake Trail, all sort of iconic high alpine Sierra trails that are multi-day trails. We typically go in the middle of the week by ourselves, and this year we picked Doozy as our trail to do. So it's 31 miles. It's further south, sort of in the Yosemite general vicinity. Mm-hmm. You go
a little north in there.
Yeah, exactly. So from Bakersfield, you go into the Sierras. So quite a bit further from Reno than trails like the Rubicon.
Don't you start that near like Courtright Reservoir?
Huh? Yeah.
And it ends at what's the pass up there near Sierra Summit? The Sherman, is it? It's not Sherman Pass. What's the?
I've only been there once, and it was about 10 years ago, to be honest.
Oh, okay.
So I've been overdue for a trip back, but it's above Shaver Lake.
Yeah, above
we're
going to
spend
Lake.
A week. There's Swamp Lake is in the area yep. also, and I haven't explored that area real extensively. So this trip has become a good excuse to get together with friends and explore
yeah,
a new
it's
area.
Awesome. I've seen video and photos of that. I mean, it's 31 miles of remote. You know, like it's more than just it's more than just remote. It's really remote as far as I know.
Right. Yeah. The trail itself is cherry stemmed between two wilderness areas. So there are no other roads in the area. It is one way in, one way out, probably comparable to the Rubicon in terms of difficulty, but longer, much less frequently traveled, which is part of the appeal. So
sure.
we're going to take our time. And as I mentioned, we're going to fish and just sort of relax and enjoy our time together.
That's going to be awesome.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to
it. I've seen videos of that guy's doing it in like fully built JKUs with giant tires and having to like ride up on the trees to get between the trees. They're so close together.
It is a very tight trail. Like Barrett Lake, it's very narrow in spots and not just rocks where you can drive over them, but trees that define the width of the trail. So fortunately, that tracker is pretty nimble, so we should be all right.
Yeah, that's going to be rad. I can't wait to see the pictures of that. Do you plan to write articles about that trip?
Yeah, I probably will. This is sort of the double-edged sword of writing stories, is that you're never off the clock. So it'll be a wonderful trip. I'll certainly bring my camera and plan to document it, and it offsets some of the costs, so that's great. But being 3 days long, also, the beauty of the magazine format is if you have 20 photos, that's enough for a story. So over 3 days, I'm sure I won't have much trouble taking 20 photos of our trip.
That'll be rad. At the same time, you know, I going on trips and having to do video and having to do photos and having to write stuff about it, there are times where I'm just like screw it, let's stay off the radar this time.
Sure. And I've done that in the past as well. If I am going with my friends, sometimes I'll just leave the camera behind,
right,
knowing that this is a pleasure trip. But I admire you for shooting video, because it is infinitely harder than shooting stills, that's for sure.
It's time consuming, that's for sure. Well, just like that, we've reached the end of episode 1 of All Terrain Podcast. My guest was Harry Wagner. Find him online at harrysituations.com and at harrysituations on Instagram. Harry, thanks for chatting with me today.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. I really appreciate the opportunity to come in.
Cool. If you have questions or comments for me or my guests, please post a comment on Instagram at All Terrain Podcast, or on our website at allterrainpodcast.com, where you'll find any links mentioned in this show, as well as videos, trip reports, and more. All Terrain Podcast was created, produced, engineered, and edited and managed by Mike Henderson. Special thanks to Chris Webster of the Archaeology Podcast Network. We needed you today because I could not figure out how to get the microphones hooked up. The podcast is recorded at Reno Collective, a co-working community in Reno, Nevada. Learn more at renocollective.com. The microphones are supplied by Colin Loretz, and the soundboard belongs to Chris Webster.